Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sangham namassami. I had a friend in he's died, but in New Zealand, who was a great philosopher in a town called Cambridge. It seems every country has a Cambridge, and he had on his mantle, he had four pictures. One was of Ramakrishna, who was a great Indian saint who lived in the beginning of the last century in Calcutta. And another picture was of Mother Teresa. And another picture of Ramana Maharshi, who was a great Indian saint who died at about 1950. And Ajahn Chah, who was a great Thai saint. And his take on spiritual practice, he divided up into three. He said there's devotional practice, spiritual practice, there's service, and there's wisdom. Wisdom, service, and devotion. And the spiritual life isn't mutually exclusive. These can be in any practice. Ramakrishna was the devotional practitioner, and he was a very, if you ever want to read a good book, read Great Swan by Lex Hickson. It's about Ramakrishna's life, and his devotion was to Kali. And if you have to understand Hindu iconography and Hindu philosophy to try to get a hold of that, but a teaching which emphasizes abandonment to God, a theistic teaching, say, giving up to the guru. In Buddhism, Pure Land Buddhism, would be devotional teachings, where you give up ego to some being, some grander principle. Service, Mother Teresa, there's a story I heard once which was kind of indicative of how she trained her nuns. She was being interviewed about one of the hospices that were being run in Calcutta. And the interviewer was praising her for the wonderful work she was doing with the dying in Calcutta. And she said, "Oh, I didn't build these places for the dying people. I built them for the nuns." Because her idea of spiritual life was service, imitation of Christ. That was her take on it. So there's a great story where a young girl was from Benares. And she was part of the caste that were in charge of burning the bodies on the Ganges, on the banks of the Ganges, and the burning ghats. And it apparently is the lowest of the low castes. She was betrothed to some, she was 13 years old or something, and she was then betrothed to someone else in the caste, and they discovered these marks on her body, and they realized it was leprosy. So she was then thrown out of her caste. So she's in the lowest of the low castes in Benares, and she gets chucked out of that. Then she wandered around and eventually ended up, and she was a very, very frightened girl, in a very, almost like a cowering puppy. And she eventually ended up in a leprosarium run by Mother Teresa. And they took her in and they cured her. And she eventually was inspired to become a nun and she took vows. And when the nuns in Mother Teresa's order take their vows, then they're also assigned a place to do service. So she was graduating, I don't know if that's the word, or ordaining, taking her vows, and they assigned her to New York City. And she was assigned to work with AIDS patients in New York. Now, in the meantime, Mother Teresa, and this was the early outbreak of AIDS in North America, so in the meantime, Mother Teresa had been pushing for an AIDS hospice in New York City, but none of the resident or North American Catholic priests and nuns wanted to do that. So she persuaded, badgered the governor of New York, or the mayor, I can't remember, who said at the time she's tougher than any mafioso he'd ever met. Apparently a very tough woman. She persuaded him to donate a house for hospice care for AIDS patients. So here's this girl. She comes from the lowest of the low castes, from Benares, ends up going into this house in New York City, in Greenwich Village. She had hauled water all her life from wells, and she had not really been in situations with running water. They go to the apartment. Mother Teresa checks out the apartment beforehand, chucks out most of the furniture. It's too comfortable. She goes in there with her fellow nuns, and it's a lovely scene where they go into the washroom and they see these taps, and they turn on the shower, and they have running water, and they just have a kind of most joyous shower with all the ropes on. And then she ended up helping all kinds of very interesting transvestites and from New York City. That's a life of service. The other two on his mantle, Ramana Maharshi and Ajahn Chah, he called them wisdom schools, Panya, or Janani yogis. And the wisdom schools they don't depend on, well, they emphasize the capacity to reflect and contemplate, to take a teaching. Not that the others don't do that. I'm not saying that it's mutually exclusive, and not that you don't have service and devotion in a punya situation. But the real thrust of it is using intellect, using the power to contemplate, but then going beyond the intellect and then doing the work that your insights show you should be doing. So it's an insightful practice. I say, I need to do this, I need to do that, I don't need to do that. So wisdom is the kind of touchstone of Theravada Buddhism. There are other forms of Buddhism, like Pure Land Buddhism is a very devotional kind of Buddhism that came up in China in later centuries. But say, like our tradition, if our like the Ajahn Chah, I had a chance to live with him, and if people became too devotional to him, like say the monks or the nuns, he just would send them off to a branch monastery. He didn't want people. I mean, you couldn't help it. He was such a radiant being, but he could see the limitation of that in that particular context. But sometimes a guru will use that in a very good way. But anyway, our tradition wouldn't emphasize the person so much as the teaching. So wisdom is talked about in various ways. One of the ways we talk about ignorance in Theravada Buddhism is that when in that which is changing, you see permanence. That's ignorance. So the example I like to always give is that if you feel inspired by something, and you don't realize that inspiration will change to neutrality, will change to boredom, then you feel very disappointed when you're not inspired anymore. So inspiration comes, fine, great. But I know it will change, then that's wisdom. If I think it's permanent, and that's, this is not necessarily conscious, it's just maybe a hopeful kind of thing deep in the subconscious, I don't realize that, then I suffer great disappointment. We do that with people. We are enthralled by them or infatuated by them, be they teachers or partners or whatever, and then when that enthrallment or infatuation changes or the inspiration changes, if we've contemplated, well, it's impossible to stay infatuated, enthralled, or inspired by any person. It's not dharma, because things change. This changes. Then as it changes, you realize, oh, that's the way it's supposed to be. I can't always be inspired by this person. But if the inspiration changes, and then there's the belief and the disappointment, and then the blaming, you have changed. That's why I'm no longer inspired. That's ignorance. Certainly a person might have changed or whatever, but the idea of inspiration, those kinds of highs can always exist. It's not dharma, we'd say. So in the permanent, where in the impermanent we see permanence, this is ignorance. In that which is not fulfilling, we try to find fulfillment. This is also ignorance. So in the same case, I seek fulfillment in another person, and I put a lot of projections and hopes on that other person, and I probably say, don't notice, my critical faculty doesn't work to notice the flaws in the person, and I feel very high with this person, and then it changes. And my critical faculty starts to function, and I think, you're not fulfilling me anymore. You're not doing what you're supposed to be doing to fulfill me. This is not the way to fulfillment. It's the way to suffering, isn't it? I think we've all probably been there in some ways with teachers, or I've certainly seen it with teachers I've been inspired with, somehow that the teacher should, or the monastery should be my place of fulfillment. So fulfillment comes not from an external thing, although external things can be supportive, it comes from an internal understanding and liberation. And then to think that that which is not really yours is yours, to think that which is not really personal is personal. So the body, say a person who suffers, say Michael Jackson, who suffers from thinking his nose is too big, and he does all these operations to get his nose right. The whole realm of plastic surgery, where people are identified with the body so much that the natural aging process, all of that is taken personally. My body, I don't look good, I don't, whatever, this is suffering. Because it's not. The body is it's not mine really, it's a function of nature. I'm not my nose. I'm not my earlobes, nor am I my body weight. So this is one of the ways we talk about ignorance. Wisdom, wisdom is described in various ways, but in a very practical way. It's described both in its as an active component of our life and also as an insightful component of our life. So wisdom is measured like to the extent that you can do things which you don't like to do but bring you happiness, that's a measure of wisdom. And conversely, the extent that you can refrain from doing things which you like to do but bring you unhappiness, that's a measure of wisdom. Yeah. The other two, the things you like to do that bring you happiness, that's a no-brainer. You do it. And the things that you don't like to do that bring you pain, that's a no-brainer. You do. You don't do those. You refrain from those. So there's some parts of our life which are very natural. We're very naturally have found ways to relax or have good friendships and so on, which are very wholesome, and there are other things which are unwholesome, which we find painful and we don't do. But the other, to do that which you don't like to do, which you know will bring you happiness, and to refrain from doing that which you like to do, but you know will bring you pain, that's more interesting. And that's more difficult, isn't it? That's the practice. And that implies two things. It implies that wisdom is an active thing in our lives. It's not simply a kind of belief, say, a Buddhist belief. Because you don't want to take up Buddhism and just accumulate it or recondition yourself to be a Buddhist. What's the point? I recondition myself from being a secularist or a Christian to become a Buddhist. It's just another set of beliefs. So it implies activity, like being able to do something. But the doing is a function of wisdom, is a function of understanding, is a function of insight. So wisdom has both the doing part and the knowing part. I do something which I don't like doing, but I know it brings me happiness. It's not just doing something because my teacher said it's good. Might be. My teacher might say, you know, if you do a bit more of this kind of practice, it might be useful to you. So you try it and say, oh yeah, it is. That is. That does work. And then I don't want to do it because it's hard to do. But I do it. Even though it's hard to do, I don't like to do it, I do it and I get a good result. Now that's wisdom, isn't it? It's not just like blind belief, but it's going against various aspects of consciousness which are unskillful, and going with those aspects of consciousness which are helpful and skillful. And that applies to so much of life, the way we think, the way we act, and the way we speak. Because even just in thinking, thinking requires energy. I have to, even though thinking might be quite habitual, it does require some kind of attention. So let's say if you're meditating and you've got an inspiring, you're doing a new patio, right? You've been dreaming about this patio for 10 years and you finally got the money together and you're sitting here meditating. But you've been talking to the architect and the gardener, and you've been looking at all the lovely brochures. And so what does your mind do? It starts to think about the patio. Why? Because that's entertaining. So you like to do that. We like to entertain the mind. And that's not immoral. It's fine. We don't do brain scans when you go out to check out what you've been up to. But to actually see the mind going to something pleasant and in meditation saying, no, I'm giving that up and I'm going to be with the breath. Why? Because I know that giving the mind a break from all its delights gives a good result. If I just say to myself, I shouldn't think, you know, I shouldn't be planning now, that's not wisdom, that's coercion, I suppose, huh? You try to coerce yourself into something which you think is peaceful, but it's not peaceful. But to actually know that how to rest the mind, say, how to bring the mind to the awareness of the space between thoughts, how to see the end of a thought, how to find that place in the mind where you're not generating past and future thoughts, past and future ideas, past and future plans, to come to that. And then so there's a knowing there, there's an insight. And then the giving up of the other becomes a training, but quite natural, because I would prefer to move to something more peaceful and more happy. So wisdom is like being able to give up something, oftentimes being able to give up something less fulfilling for something more fulfilling. It is about our own happiness. It is about our more happiness. So what you come up against then in this kind of practice is the frustration of unfulfilled desire. But desire which doesn't bring skillful results. So if I am with someone and they are acting in some way which I'm finding annoying, and my habit is just to dump on them. That's a habit. But I notice that when I do that, I just blurt out wrong speech, that the result isn't good. I don't feel connected. I feel alienated. I feel regret and remorse and so on. I say, well, that's not a good result. That's knowing, isn't it? That's insight. That comes from what? That comes from mindfulness. I watch and I observe. What am I doing and what are the results of my life? How am I thinking? How am I speaking? And what are those results? And if the results are unskillful, unpleasant, unhappiness, I start to make determinations. I say, don't go that path. Don't think that way. Don't speak that way. Don't act that way, because it'll just bring you unhappiness. But even though I might have that insight, it might be actually quite difficult to remember it and then to act on it. So then the impulse comes up to just be critical of someone or dump on someone, and I have enough mindfulness to feel that impulse and say, I'm going to wait. I'm going to wait this one out. Now that's very uncomfortable, because the comfortable thing, because of my habit, is just to put it out there, dump on the person, release the pressure. But I've seen I do that. I do that and I get a bad result. And I'd rather not be unhappy. I'd rather be happy. And I see when I am more maybe sincere or more connected or more empathetic, the result is actually very good. It makes my heart more peaceful. I feel more connected. So I'm in a kind of inner struggle, which we're all in this kind of struggle. Now, if I just say I should always speak nicely, and I should never feel unkindness or criticism, or then that's just another kind of violent opinion I have about myself. But wisdom isn't that way. Wisdom realizes that consciousness functions according to patterns and habits and such like. So the wisdom teachings are saying, well, there's work to be done. This doesn't just come like snapping your finger. There's work to be done. And so the impulse arises to, as in this example, to dump on someone, and there's enough mindfulness, awareness, to say, ah, there's that one. And I'm going to choose to refrain from doing that. Now, that's not repression. You're not saying you don't feel that, but it's not indulgence either. It's not hating oneself. It's not judging oneself. It's just saying, with action based on this impulse, I'm going to be unhappy. That's kamma. And I don't want that kamma. I don't want that resultant kamma of unhappiness. So I'm not going to say anything. And I hold it for 5 minutes and then I blur it out. And I dump on them anyway. There I go. Then feel the result. I feel the result, and the result is, oh. And then usually, if we're really working on ourselves, we just hate ourselves. Oh, I did it again. I dumped on them. But that's not wisdom. That's self-view. This is not self. So wisdom is that seeing in that which is ignorance is seeing or thinking that in that which is not self, there's a self. That's ignorance. So what we're looking at is cause and effect, karma. So the cause of this unhappiness is because the motivation was from unkindness, was from cruelty, was from divisiveness. That's all. With this as condition, you get that as a result. So how can I change that result in the future? Right there, I have to accept that, okay, this is the result. Feel it, Virudhamma. Feel, what does this feel like? This is awful. I really don't like this. That's our feel. This is the result. So you begin to get wisdom. Wisdom arises from seeing cause and effect rather than from self-hatred, self-judgment. That's not wisdom. That's just self-judgment. But seeing cause and effect, with this as condition, that arises. When I say this, I get that result. You start to feel that result. Then the intention, the wise intention, is next time that comes up, I'm going to try to be mindful, not follow it. That's different than saying I'm a terrible person, for dumping on my partner or my friend. Socially, we apologize and we do what's appropriate. But inwardly, this work we're doing, that's the thing we keep trying to see. What are the results of my life? Because today, yesterday, the way, you know, the things that come to me internally are the results of the way I've thought and I've acted to some extent. And they're also influenced by things that have come from the outside. And then the other, when I see that I pause and I don't just jump on someone, or I'm empathetic or I'm attentive, and I see the result of that, that's a really good result. That sense of empathy and hearing and listening. And then I might be critical, I might be supportive, but I see that where I come from compassion, from empathy, is a good result. And I know that does give a good result. So I have more and more energy to do that. But that doesn't mean that I always feel compassionate or kind. I guess that's not the way it is. It's this way. It's always the way things are. So that gives wisdom, because sometimes Buddhism is a very... It has a very strong intellectual culture around it, especially Theravada, a lot of analytical principles and so on, and a lot of lists. And one could certainly just sort of leave it as a bunch of ideas, but that wouldn't be wisdom, because it would just be a bunch of ideas. And a bunch of ideas which are not implemented in a life are simply another bunch of ideas. Pick any ideas you want. So I might feel very clever with my bunch of ideas, but the real litmus test is, am I happy? Is my heart at ease? Do I feel more alienated from my fellow beings? Am I addicted to thinking? Do I notice the silence of the mind? Can I operate in a way where all those factors of gratitude and empathy and compassion become stronger? Now, that's not a demand that you be grateful all the time, but it is a suggestion that gratitude can be cultivated, compassion can be cultivated, and that greed, hatred, and delusion can be abandoned. But it is a process. It is a work that we do rather than something you suddenly get by taking a label of Buddhist, spiritual, whatever. One of the frustrating parts of the training, I think, that we all have is we do get insight. You know, we see ourselves in action, and we see how one particular way of motivation, where we're motivated to speak, act, and think in ways which are according to compassion and wisdom, give us such good results. Such good results. And the other, the kind of habits of self-disparagement or worry or whatever, give us such bad results. We get the insight. We see that clearly, and yet we do it. It's so frustrating. I don't know about you. It's just so here it goes again. So there has to be a kind of sense of being in for the long haul. Otherwise, it can be very, very discouraging. So you have to encourage yourself to continue with these intentions to act in ways which are appropriate, and that's wisdom. So even if I have an insight around my character and I lose mindfulness and I act in ways which are unskillful, that moment I notice the result, then right there I have to somehow encourage right practice rather than self-disparaging practice. And the right practice is, this is the result. Be careful in the future. This is a result. Do more of that in the future because it's wholesome. And then it opens up. It has to open up, because the way the love karma works is that if you make the right causes, you get the right results. It just has to be that way. It's nature. It's just the nature of things. So it's in the nature of things that if I think in ways and I motivate myself in ways which are driven by anger and aversion and so on, the result can't be happy. It just can't be. It's just not possible. Right? So whenever aversion arises, be it aversion to myself or others, don't believe it. Don't motivate thought with that. So even if you, even if I blow it, as it were, and do or say or eat or whatever in some unskillful way, in that moment of awakening, may I be free from suffering, rather than I'm an idiot. Much more skillful. Because what you're doing, you're putting in the heart compassion. And then motivating, sure, okay, may I be from suffering, and may I not dump this on my partner, or whatever it is, my fellow monk. Or... So there's a sense of compassion, but determination. It's not a kind of woolly self-forgiveness and then an indulgence in it once again. Oh, you poor thing, you dumped on someone. Let's do it again. This is not wisdom, this is stupidity. So wisdom is the capacity, or the extent to which I can do things which I don't want to do, but I know that by doing them, they'll bring me happiness, and vice versa. The extent to which I can refrain from doing things which I like to do, but I know bring me unhappiness. I think that's probably a lifetime's work. All right, I'll leave that for your reflection. We could finish with some chanting.